I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hey, welcome back. You know who this is and what this is. It's Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. And guess what? I'm here on an in-between week. You've probably become accustomed to our Surf News episodes every 2 weeks that I co-host with Scott Bass. That's not exactly how this show started out. It started out doing that every 2 weeks, but then the alternating weeks were long-form interviews, profile pieces with surfboard shapers, photographers, filmmakers, publishers, authors, professional surfers, basically all sorts of different industry leaders, movers and shakers in the surf world. And that's a passion project of mine. I like the long-form interview. I like the podcast platform. I think it's perfect for long-form interview. And but I've fallen away from doing it just because life has gotten busy. But I'm bringing it back. So, thrilled to be back. And also, thrilled to have this particular guest, Matt Parker, who has a company, surfboard company. He's a surfboard shaper. He has a brand called Album Surfboards. You probably follow him on Instagram. Really, really incredible work. And comes from an unlikely background for a shaper, really. But it's a great story for you, listener, you the listener, who might be interested in surfboard shaping. He just started from scratch with no family background or lineage, or without even living near the beach, actually. So we get into that a little bit in this episode, and we get into technical details that you might have interest in, even if you're not interested in being a shaper, but just as a surfer who wants to understand the craft under your foot. We talk about construction material. We talk about design detail. We talk about asymmetry, which is something that he's explored. Finless surfing, which is something that he's currently exploring. And Matt is a smart dude and articulate, so that goes a long way in this podcast platform. Hope that you enjoy it. You can follow us on social media at Surf Splendor. A couple of Instagrams that have just kind of caught fire this past week, and we've gained a lot of followers because of that. So a lot of people tagging other people in those posts, which is how that thing grows, obviously, and that's been really cool to see. So I appreciate that. But it's still a lot, significantly fewer followers there than we have listeners and downloads of each episode. So we could still see growth there, but I don't give a crap about that. Really, I just want listeners for the podcast really more than anything. So that having more listeners will allow us to attract bigger guests. People that want to promote their product will want to come on here. And then eventually we could attract advertisers as well, which if we could actually see revenue from this, then we can make it, you know, certainly make episodes every week. And it'd be amazing to do it more than once a week, in fact, if it ever got to that point. Those are long-term goals. Really, I mean, all you got to do is share the show with friends. That helps us grow. We're, 3 years into this thing, at least 3 years, probably almost 4 years into it now. So, yeah, crazy. Anyway, enjoy this episode. Leave feedback on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. There's a comment section. You could chime in there. We'll send your message to Matt if you leave a comment on his show. And, yeah, I think that's it. That's all I got to say. Without further ado, Matt Parker, Album Surfboards. I'll be back at the end to sign us off. Matt Parker, Album Surf. Album Surfboards Manufacturing Company. What's the appropriate full title here?
Album Surfboards, yeah.
All right, cool.
By itself, that's good. That
cool.
Works.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be here.
Yeah. So I think customers have a little bit of a awareness of you. Obviously, we did like a 10-minute intro when you lent me that surfboard. This is meant to be the more thorough breakdown of who you are, why you are, what we're doing.
All right.
So you've listened to the show before. You get it.
I love the show.
Thanks, man. That's what I really wanted to hear. I was prepping myself for a compliment.
I listened to it while I'm shaving, actually.
Do you?
Yeah.
Sweet, man. Mm-hmm. Thanks. It's rad. It's grown to the point where I've started to get feedback from people outside the surf industry. Like a friend of mine who's in LA who doesn't surf at all, she actually said that she was at a house party and she saw William Finnegan's Barbarian Days on somebody's counter, and she knew that I recorded an episode with him, and she's like, oh, I've heard of that book before, where'd you get that? And he's like, oh, I heard about it on a podcast I listened to. She's like, what podcast? And he said, and she's like, no way, I know that guy. So I've started to get, like, it's grown enough to where I've started to get feedback outside of our tiny little circle, you know?
That's awesome.
I know, man. That's, it feels really very cool. Gratifying. Yeah. At any rate, so it's funny, you know, you and I have crossed paths over the last couple of years a few times. I feel like you and I come from a very similar background, and we're actually from a similar part in Orange County. Mm-hmm. Most people that I interview, especially surfboard shapers, I have so little in common with, you know? Yeah. And like, and I don't shape boards, so I don't even have that in common with them, but it's like they come from some, either a storied background or Hawaii, or their dad worked with tools, and so they have like some sort of building background, which I always feel like I'm an outsider kind of trying to glean a little something from the outside, where it's like you and I feel like, dude, we came from the same cloth. You just happened to get into board building and I didn't.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so. I'm way older than you, though.
I don't think you're way older. So let's give listeners a little bit of what that background looks like. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get involved in surfing before board building even?
Yeah, so I grew up a little inland. So I grew up in Orange, city of Orange, which is like 30 minutes from the beach. But I always grew up obsessed with skating and surfing. And all I wanted as a kid was a surfboard. You know, that was like the dream someday. But I'd get dropped. My mom would take us to Newport and drop us off, and we'd spend the day at the beach.
Right.
But I always wanted to be able to surf. And so since I didn't really grow up right at the beach, I didn't really get a first surfboard maybe till I was like 13, you know, junior high or something like that.
Yeah, same age for me.
Yeah, and so, as soon as I got that surfboard, I was the obsession reached new heights. And
yeah.
I was always really fascinated with just how there was always this mystery. Since I didn't grow up right around it, there was a mystery to me about how do they glass a surfboard and how are these fins attached to it? And,
so
how did they come up with the shapes and all that kind of
stuff?
Your
fascination was to do with the board construction itself.
I loved, you know, I would gobble up any surfer magazine or any movie or anything like that. But the actual craft, the board, the actual product itself was so interesting to me. So
it's funny. So what I was talking about, feeling like an outsider looking in when I'm interviewing people, that's the same experience I had being slightly inland, being 13 by the time I got into it. I felt like I went to the beach and all these kids live in walking distance, and that's why they're surfing so good. And I've always kind of felt like an outsider as well. And but I wasn't as fascinated with the construction of surfboards like you were, but carry on with your story.
Yeah. So I had that same kind of perspective where I was fascinated with it and I was obsessed with it, but I was always a little bit kind of peering in from, you know, not right up close to it since I wasn't right there. So, and yeah, so I grew up surfing and had other interests too. You know, I did a lot of different things. I skated a lot. I was into snowboarding a lot. I worked for Burton Snowboards when I went to school for a little while. Lived away from in the mountains for a little bit.
What mountains?
Utah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Salt Lake for a little bit. And
wow.
Did like demo tours with Burton Snowboards and did all sorts of different stuff like that.
Hmm.
Always came back to surfing because I was always like the passion and the thing that I was into the most. But it was good to kind of, like, art was my background, and so I went to school for art and went to school for design. And so when I went to school in different places, I went and experienced different things. And
got it. That's something I'd like to actually tease apart a little bit is I'm always curious what it is about surfing specifically that is unique. And I'll ask that question sometimes, like, why surfing? And people go, oh, well, it's because you're in nature and it's a individualistic sport and there's no team. But I would argue, so is snowboarding. Snowboarding has those similarities, but for some reason,
you're more passionate about surfing. Maybe you're not, but I don't mean to speak for you, but like people are, you know, they come back to surfing mm-hmm. and it has a certain spiritual component that I don't think snowboarding or skating has. Do you want to speak about that or does it, or no, were those things all equal for you?
I think surfing has like this, kind of fleeting addiction, like where the moments you have in surfing, you can't pre-plan necessarily.
And okay.
You can't just say, I'm getting off the lift and I'm riding down the hill or I'm going to go skate this ramp
mm-hmm.
whenever I want. So that surfing thing is a little bit more elusive. And so I think it keeps you kind of, it's like you always get a little bit of a taste of it every time you go, even when you go on a surf trip. It's like, I don't know if, I mean, we get surfed out when there's a good swell, but there's always a little bit of that taste that you always want a little bit more of that. And that feeling is so unique and so varied. You know, there's so many different experiences within surfing, whether there is a swell and you're charging really good waves and there's the fear element and the different sensations of surfing heavier surf versus like going out on a longboard on a 1 foot day and just relaxing and cruising. So there's all these varied options and sensations that come along with that, I think, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think the element of unpredictability and not being able to plan. You could go on a surf trip and you get skunked.
Yeah. You know? You can't, like, it's out of your control. You know, there's so many things out of your control.
Yeah, that makes the reward of it a lot more meaningful, I think.
More satisfying when you do score, or when things do align and come together. It's a little bit more magical, I think.
Yeah. So. You know, there's another element, I think, as I'm just unpacking it in my mind. I think like living in the moment is something that I've tried to embrace as I've gotten older, you know, and I find that my most gratifying experiences in life are when I'm able to fully live in the moment. If you're reflecting on the past, you have regret. And if you're looking at the future, you have anxiety, sort of a thing. So you want to kind of just always be in the moment. And surfing, I think, really requires you to do that, because using that riding up the chairlift example, you're looking at the slope as you're passing it going, oh, I'm going to hit that mm-hmm. bank or whatever. And then you go out there and you apply it. Whereas surfing, there's no way really to plan for it. Mm-hmm. And even when you stand up on the wave, if you're thinking about things that you've done in the past and how you're going to apply it to this wave, you generally, those aren't your best performances. Your best performances are you get up and forget everything that you learned and let muscle memory take over.
Totally.
And you know.
I think there's a real beauty in surfing too, in that you can have five terrible waves in a row where you blew it and you're just frustrated.
Yeah.
Or somebody back paddles you or whatever and you just can't get a wave, but it's like instantaneously it can change and you can turn the page so quickly and be next wave, everything aligns and it's like goes just great, or half the crowd leaves.
Yeah.
Or the sun comes out. Or the tide gets just right. And so there's always, that's why surfers, I think, inherently are optimistic, you know, like, oh, as soon as the tide gets good, it's going to get good.
Or right.
Wind shifts, it's going to get good. But I think that there's a lot of truth to that, because I can relate that to life. My boys, I have five kids.
Do you really? I didn't know
I've,
that.
I have full crew of kids, but two of my boys love to surf with me all the time, my 10-year-old, my 13-year-old. And they'll be out there and they'll get frustrated with the wave. And it's a good life lesson for them to learn that it's like, you know, new session starts right now. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as you decide it to be, it does. And you can, next wave can be, make your session.
So. Surfing provides so many metaphors for life if you're tuned into it, you know.
Totally.
It's so, so good. All right. I'm going to get back on track. I have a bunch of philosophical thoughts that I could meander with, but I'll get back on track. So you were into snowboarding and you were into skating, but you said you came back to surfing. Is it because it was more meaningful for you than snowboarding, or is it
I always loved it the best.
Okay, got it.
I always loved it the best, but it was also, it's also, you know, it's difficult, you know, to get good. It takes a lot of time. So like snowboarding is a sport that you can get good in a season. You know, you can learn how to do it and a week later you know how to go ride powder or go down the hill.
Right.
You know, but surfing is always, there's like this eternal progression of always trying to get better and improving and stuff like that. So that's kind of fuels coming back to it a little bit as well.
Yeah. You know? So when you moved back to California, when did you get involved in board building?
So I started shaping like 2000, 2001, you know, something like that. So I was probably 24.
Oh, okay.
25 when I first went and picked up a blank. And
what was the impetus? And did you learn under somebody, or how did
not
happen?
The first, I think I shaped like 25 boards without even a planer. I think I just used a sure form and a saw, and like I would get these close tolerance Clark blanks and just skin them with the sure form. I would draw the outlines and just kind of like grind it out, you know.
Why? You know, did you not know that planers were available?
No, it was like I think the first board I did, I was like, okay, I was like, what are the bare minimum tools I need to get going? You know,
yeah.
Like maybe it was not enough patience. I wanted to shape it that day, and I wouldn't have to like figure out power tools and all that stuff. So I was like, all right, I need some sanding screen. I need a sanding block. I need like a little block plane to cut the stringer and a sure form, and that's. I'll figure out racks to shape in. I'll figure out all that kind of stuff, so as long as I can hack it out.
Just in the backyard or in the garage?
Yeah, in the backyard.
Okay.
And so it remarkably, you know, miraculously, I guess, it turned out like okay.
Mm.
And went and took it and got it glassed. And I didn't glass it myself or anything like that, but it went and got it glassed and surfed it. And that was like, all right, I can see 28 things I need to fix about this board.
Okay.
It works. But I've totally seen how I can improve it, and the next one's going to be so much better. So I took that first one and put it on consignment in a shop, and some sucker bought it.
What was it? Was it a short board?
It was a short board. It was like a hybrid-y kind of short board.
Okay.
Like a flat deck, kind of wider short board.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, put on consignment. Somebody bought it and took the money and bought another blank. And,
okay.
You know? Proceeded to hack out, you know, a bunch of boards like that, just in my garage or in a backyard, just by myself, you know, just kind of, I would peer in, like, at the glass shop, and I asked a lot of questions, but it was mostly just trial and error, just figuring it out.
For somebody listening, I mean, we live in Southern California where we have access to glass shops and blanks even and things like that, but what glass shop was it, and how do you even know which tools to buy? And where did you get the tools? Like,
Brad at Foam EZ.
Okay,
that's where I bought my first blank and got my first tools and asked him a bunch of questions. And then Steve Adler, who was next door to him, had Surfboard Factory.
Yeah,
he had a little glassing factory there in Westminster.
Okay, and they were just open for anybody who wanted to drop off.
I was living in Irvine at the time, and it was like, all right, you know, this is. I was still going to school too. I was taking classes at Chapman for design, getting my design degree, and so it kind of fit in what I was doing. And just poked around and figured it out that way.
Whose boards were you writing at the time?
I think I had like a couple Aletics from Sean Jensen.
Okay,
just probably off the rack used boards from the shops up in Newport and stuff like that.
Yeah. So. Okay. And talk a little bit about your design background, because I think that factors in pretty significantly with Album Surf.
Yeah.
What were you studying and what were your aspirations?
Yeah, so I went to school for design. It took me a while to figure out that I was like, oh, there's a career you can make in doing that. I was always visually minded, you know. When I was a kid, I would trace and sketch out surf logos in my notebook or whatever. Mm-hmm. When the next to my little pictures of surf drawings, you know.
Yeah.
So I was always into that aspect of it. So I went to school for design, and so design, when you go to school for that, you learn all the other visual elements and 3D elements. You take sculpture classes and you learn painting. I used to paint all the time, and so I was into visual mediums. So I think that translated into being able to see a blank and being able to visualize at the end what I wanted this board to look like and what curves look right and which ones look wonky and how water's going to flow through this three-dimensional object. You kind of just like pick it up, and it seemed to make sense. The math made sense in my head intuitively, I think. So
as you went to school for that and started to realize that it was a viable career,
mm-hmm.
You were also shaping boards simultaneously. Which career did you decide to pursue? And
yeah, So I was freelance. When I was going to school, I was freelancing as a designer. So I would do logo projects or little branding or advertising campaigns or little... And my good friend, Nathan Harris, and I grew up together, and he was freelancing as a web designer.
Okay.
And so it just made sense to pool our clients together. And so we started an agency, and that agency is called Album Agency. And so...
Where does the name come from?
We always liked the idea that an album has multiple meanings, you know, how you can hear a song as an adult that you heard when you were a kid on a road trip, and it instantly takes you back. And so it kind of evokes these emotional responses, the sounds that you hear. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of duality to that. And then also, you know, like a visual album, you know, you look at pictures and photographs and it can kind of put you in that same emotional state. And it just seemed to... It's a fun way to brand ourselves too. We could kind of draw music influence on just the stuff that we put out and what it looked like. And
okay. So the agency itself is a design and...
It's a design and branding agency, yep.
Got it.
Not really in the surf world related, but it's upstairs from our surfboard showroom.
Okay.
And that's been in business for, I guess, 16 years, 15 years, something like that.
Longer than the surfboard brand.
About the same time. So okay. I started shaping boards. I was freelancing as a designer. We launched the agency or the company, and we've been doing design ever since. And then the surfboards was always like this side project that really steadily grew, but it grew without the pressure of, like, you know, I mean, a couple years in, it's like I didn't know enough to... I'm going to be a surfboard shaper and have a surfboard business. It's like,
right.
I was still, you know, still figuring it out. And so, what was cool is we had the agency that I was going to work at every day and doing that and make boards on the side and learn a lot of things. And I'd be, you know, as the months go on, you make more and more boards and you figure more things out and mm-hmm. try different things and the boards get better. And then, you know, as, I would say in the last 7 or 8 years, the surfboard label has taken like a more of a in the forefront. It's the main thing that I do, and in the last couple of years, it's all I do because it's growing and we're, you know,
yeah.
sending boards all over the world, and you know,
it requires a lot of time.
Yeah, it's taken off. So
it's interesting. You know, I always am concerned when people take a passion or an art kind of passion project and then try to make a living off of it. Mm-hmm. And the way that you grew yours was so much more organic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the danger being, like, if you love photography and you're going to be a professional photographer, the moment that your income is reliant on that, it changes the art.
Totally.
It just changes the way that you view it. You compromise and take work that you probably wouldn't have taken just because you've got to pay your rent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what a fortunate situation that you were in to be able to explore something creatively without needing to cover expenses.
Yeah, it could happen organically. It's a very cliche word, but it really could happen organically where it grew. And we didn't really have rules about,
yeah,
we have to make a certain amount of boards and we got to, you know, be hitting these sales numbers to survive. There wasn't anything about that. It was just purely for the, well, let's try and see what this shape does. And
yeah.
Let's explore this design and let's see what this fin setup feels like
mm-hmm.
without really the real world repercussions
mm-hmm.
until, you know, we kind of figured it out enough to know, okay, we feel good about what we're putting out there and let's make a run at it a little bit more.
Well, another interesting detail I think is you learned how to run a business with the agency,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people who get into surfing don't ever learn how to run a business, you
sure.
know, and that's why I think surfing as a whole, on the garment side, on the surfboard side, it's been a very slow growing industry
mm-hmm.
because it's run by a lot of people who weren't educated.
Totally.
You know, and don't have best accounting practices and that sort of stuff.
That was a frustration initially why I wanted to try and make my own board was, you know, you kind of get sick of getting the runaround. You know, you order a board and you have that impatience. You want to go surf it right then because that design and that size board is suiting the waves you're thinking about right then. And then it's 6 months later and your board shows up and you're kind of, oh, yeah.
You're right. The thrill is gone a little bit.
Yeah, so I wanted that, you know.
quicker response to it, I guess.
It's funny that you can build a board quicker for yourself than you could through a professional manufacturer, you know? It's a sad state of affairs. Yeah. So what kind of boards were you interested in building, and how have you established yourself as a brand? Do you have a certain style? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I've always, I think you should always be, as far as it relates to surfboards, you should always be open-minded to try, because the whole point is to have fun.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're not doing this to score any points. Right. We're not on tour or anything like that. So the whole point is to have fun. So you should always be open-minded to try something that maybe, you know, who knows, could be something really fun, give you a new experience that you didn't think about. So I'll try anything and ride anything. And so our line of models is pretty diverse. You know, we have everything from classic longboards to finless shapes to performance shortboards to Simmons influenced little stubbies to classic fish designs, hybrids of all those in between. You know, so a lot of different stuff. And so we've always done a lot of custom boards. That's kind of what we're known for. It's a lot of our boards are very individual looking and unique and different colorways, and so I would say I try to ride the best board for the day, you know, depending on the conditions. And so if that's a little performance shortboard one day, I took my kids out yesterday and it was 1 foot glassy little uppers, and I took out a finless to learn how to ride a little finless on a day like that, because, you know, why not?
How'd it go?
It was really fun. I had little cheater Bonzer side runners.
That's
on
what
it.
I need.
It was training wheels, you know?
Yeah.
Finless with training wheels, but it was insanely fun.
What? How big is the board? How wide is it? How
it's 6.0. It's that one right there, actually.
Oh.
It's that weird. It's 6.0 by 19 3/4. Kind of a Simmons like style planing hull shape, really straight outline. With a really deep, it's not really a swallowtail. I don't even know what I would call that.
I don't know how to explain that.
But it's
either.
Like a 10 inch deep, it's almost like a Mackie influenced fishtail, where the extended swallow wings, I guess, are foiled really thin. So there's the idea of maybe there's going to be some little flex characteristics in those, you know, to help kind of project and steer a little bit, you know.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than 1 billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
To explain it visually for the listeners, the board is, the nose is on the ground and the tail sticking up. And looking at the tail this way, it almost looks like a fox's head with ears going straight up, you know?
Or like a tuning fork or something.
Yeah,
like that,
tuning fork's even better, actually. Like giant, giant tail, basically.
But it was really fun.
I'm going to take a photo of that. I'll post it. Well, so I've ridden some finless boards for a little while now, and it can be so frustrating.
Yeah.
And it can be, it makes a 1 foot day at uppers a lot more fun because you pretty much wouldn't be having that much fun out there.
Otherwise.
You wouldn't even paddle out. Yeah. So, but my problem is I need those side bite fins mm-hmm. because it just gets too slippery and you got to stay so low and crouched mm-hmm. that I'm just uncomfortable staying in that position.
Yeah. The guys that are really good can just have a feel for it. It requires more concentration for me to ride a pure finless board. And on those little small tiny days, I don't really want to give like full concentration to that. So the little cheater, little Bonzer side runners on it lets you kind of just, you can blank out a little bit and still not lose your line.
Good. So, yeah. I got to get on those. Do you make them yourself or?
They're just like long Bonzer side runners.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
You go on there.
Okay, cool. I got to get those. So we talked with the board that you let me borrow is asymmetrical. We mm-hmm. talked a little bit about asymmetry, mm-hmm. and that's something that Album Surf has kind of embraced. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have a conversation about asymmetry. Yeah. Even though we covered it in the last conversation, like we should probably start from scratch.
Sure.
It makes a lot of sense. I'll lay some of the groundwork and ask you to chime in. Asymmetry makes a lot of sense philosophically from a design standpoint to me as a surfer. And I've ridden a number of asymmetrical boards. I still find myself in a position where I can't fully advocate for it. Mm-hmm. And that's not because the boards that I've ridden don't work. It's because I can't say that they work better than a symmetrical board, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So I find myself, I want to believe because I believe in the philosophy and the boards have worked, but I still am such a pragmatist that I need data. Mm-hmm. I need data points, and it's too difficult to collect data points because the waves are always changing and I can't make two boards that are exactly the same, but one with asymmetrical characteristics. So I'll lay the groundwork for the listener in terms of why it makes sense philosophically. And that is, nothing that you do in surfing is symmetrical. Your body, your foot, the wave, the way that water traverses a board, none of that happens symmetrically. So there's no reason why the craft that you're riding should be symmetrical. So, I mean, Donnie Brink, who also does asymmetrical boards, was the one who kind of enlightened me to this, which is that, look, your foot has a heel and a toe, and they're entirely different. And your heel has the ability to push, which your toe does as well, but your toe has the ability to leverage, which your heel doesn't. You're more weight on your heels. So your toe side rail should have certain characteristics that allow leverage to take place, and your heel side rail should have more foam, for one thing, to handle the extra weight that's being pushed and doesn't need the sensitivity that your toe side can have because of the leverage thing. And it also translates to outlines, but so all of that makes perfect sense. Let's design a board for the anatomy of your foot. Mm-hmm. And also, like I said, the wave isn't symmetrical and the way that the water traverses across the board isn't symmetrical. So let's factor all those things in. So there's the groundwork for the philosophy. There's a lot of also problems with that philosophy in that, well, now you're making room for a million different variables. And within each of those variables, there's a bunch of variables like, yeah, the wave traverses asymmetrically, but in which direction, at which time, and it's always changing. Mm-hmm. And then what if it's choppy and what if it's not? So, mm-hmm. Based on what I just said, what gaps can you fill in? Why is it a design focus for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am not a hydrodynamicist, you know,
fair enough. Okay.
So I'm not a scientist. I'm more, I can understand it by feeling it when I go out and ride it.
Okay.
And knowing how it works based on my own experiences. And so I'm also, as a designer, I tend to think simpler solutions are generally better.
Occam's razor.
You know, so I'm hesitant to over-engineer a situation. I tend to think the simplest solution is the best way to go, you know? And so sometimes if you try to over-engineer something, you can go down a rabbit hole of trying to solve other problems or creating whole new variables that you weren't thinking about. So with all the asymmetrical boards I've done, I basically, you know, you see Ryan Birch out there shredding on one and just looking like so reactive and responsive and quick, or you know, and so that inspires me. So I'm like, all right, so let me take the boards that I'm familiar with, and I know that work, and let's apply some of that theory to and keep it somewhat simple. And so I love twin fins, you know, and so I love the speed of a twin. So I want to apply that feeling of a twin fin under my toes because I feel like it generates a ton of speed that's really drag free. But maybe, you know, we can apply like quad thinking on my heels, where a tighter rail line in the outline and fins positioned under my heel of my foot are going to give me a little bit better response. And especially backside, it's going to give me a tighter arc that I can draw at full speed, give me different angles I can take on turns. I think about fin placement on an asymmetrical is it feels like a joystick on your back foot for me. So that twin fin is placed right under my toes, and by where the heel side rail line cuts away and where the fins are placed under my heels, that quad cluster is right under the pivot point of my heel. And so different than a normal board where sometimes you're up in the front of your fin boxes to generate speed and you slide your foot back over the center fin to really be in the sweet spot for the turn that you want to make.
Right.
With an asymmetrical, for me, it's like a toe heel response where those fins are connected to as extensions of my feet all the time. And so that toe is my accelerator with that big fangy twin fin that I can really pivot around and drive and project and get speed down the line. And then as I roll to my heel side rail, maybe for a front side carve, I get the grip and the drive and the tighter arc I can draw with that quad cluster.
Okay.
And so that's at least that's how I feel it, and that's how I experience it, and that's how I've been able to translate it. And you know, I have there's some guys that ride for me that their whole quivers are asymmetrical now, from their 5.2 fish up to an 8.7 gun.
Wow.
You know? So all their boards are set up that way because it feels more intuitive. You know, I think sometimes people see them and it looks weird, and so you think, oh, that's going to take me a while to figure out. But for me, they feel really intuitive because you pop up and your foot is right over the fins, and it's like, oh, I can control this and make this go, and it reacts to what I do really instantly.
That's entirely true about the board that I borrowed from you. It definitely had like a very sensitive feel to it. Mm-hmm. Every little adjustment of weight that I applied was instantly translated through the board itself. So I think that how you started that conversation, I want to come back to it because it's important. The fastest over-engineering is a problem. Mm-hmm. And so the best solution is the shortest solution. And you're saying that asymmetry is actually not a more confusing solution. It's not a more layered variables that you're adding. It's actually the more logical, shorter conclusion.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah. I mean, for instance, so I'm riding, I love riding twin fins, you know, it's like in Southern California, we surf kind of weak waves, slopey face waves. I surf out at Point Breaks around Trestles a lot. And those, you know, those waves don't have a lot of push. So twin fins really fly there and they really generate, they're just fun to ride. So I was riding one that I love, and I had plenty of rights where it felt really good. And then I'm taking a left, and you know, there's times when you can't really push it the same way as a thruster, as your performance board. You kind of maybe have to nurse a little bit of that, you know, off the bottom and in the hook a little bit. And you don't feel like maybe sometimes you get the same speed generation. So I'm like, all right, well, let's take this exact same board and just reconfigure that heel side fin cluster as a quad, because I know I'm going to get grip and it's still going to feel like a twin, you know, rolling back and forth. And so that's the simplicity of just solving that, you know,
right.
Just like designing a board and coming up with that. It still feels like a twin when I'm riding it.
Yeah.
But it has more grip.
Right.
You know, so.
That is a misconception though. Everybody I talk to thinks that it's confusing the design process or adding more complexity to the mm-hmm. design process. Yet everybody I know that's had success, both shapers and surfers, explain it the way you just explain it, which it's like, no, it's the opposite of that, actually. Mm-hmm. It looks more complex, mm-hmm. but it's actually a more logical solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes back to, once you understand the anatomy of your foot and the anatomy of a wave, it is actually a more logical mm-hmm. solution.
Yeah, in my way of designing it or coming up with the way that works for me is, like I said, I'm not doing any math formulas.
Right.
You know, no geometry involved here. It's like just taking a board out that I know that works and then modifying something as a feel thing and then just getting the instant feedback and surfing those for a few months and realizing like, oh yeah, there's something here.
Yeah.
You know?
It's the beauty and kind of the challenge of surfing and trying to evolve design in the industry is that so much of it is based on feel and not quantifiable data.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Scott earlier today, actually, and we were talking about board construction materials and about EPS or whatever versus poly. And it's like, well, no, poly just feels better. He's like, yeah, what does that mean? And I'm like, I don't know. It just feels right, you know? And he's like, well, let's talk about it. I'm like, no, I've tried to talk about it at length with shapers, with surfers on the podcast. Like, I can't. The human language fails me. Yeah. You know, I can't explain why it just feels better. I mean, you could use the word dampening. You can use sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
EPS is real quirky, whereas poly. But there's no other way than just to say it feels right.
Yeah. You know? No, it is very true. It's very true.
Let's talk about construction materials that you use at Album Surf. It appears that you use a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
What are your preferences? And
yeah, we do. We, like I said, you gotta be open minded.
Okay.
You know, because who knows, right? You don't know until you try it or see what works. So we'll try anything. We'll try any core, any glassing setup. But yeah, we do everything from PU to EPS to varial foam. We'll use super sap eco resin stuff on some boards. We'll use, you know, old school Volon cloth on log, you know, anything really.
What do you like riding?
Same kind of scenario where I like what's best for the day.
Okay.
And sometimes what's best for the day is to try something new.
Okay.
You know, I've been riding the same thing for a few weeks straight, and let's try something new and see what this construction or what this core feels like as compared to something else. Or it's, you know, the wind's really howling, and I just want like a heavier board that's going to get down the face mm-hmm. or something, you know? So I think it's, my personal quiver has everything in it. So.
What's the majority of the construction in your quiver and what's the percentage of that
majority? The majority is probably standard.
Like, polyurethane?
Yeah.
Foam?
PUP is probably standard.
Okay.
But I'm more so, doing R&D with different shapes and different bottom contours and things like that. And so that construction is a good middle ground that I know is consistent in how it feels.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, building the boards is easy to do that way. So.
Right. How actively do you watch WSL and all that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah. Contests? I love it. I watch it all. I'll watch every heat I can. You know, it's all
you?
Interesting to me. Yeah, I totally love it.
We've got right now, obviously, Matty Wilco in mm-hmm. first. John Florence, Gabe Medina, second and third. Who are you going for this?
Well, I would love to see John. I watched his two of those, his last like 12 episodes, the, whatever those.
Yeah, the series is called 12. There's been two episodes.
It's so good.
Crazy, right?
It's so insane. I mean, I think as far as the best surfer in the world, I mean, who can hang with, who can surf Waimea like that and surf Jaws like that and surf Rio Beach Break like that, and so you know, no biases aside, I think he's the best surfer. So if the tour should produce the best surfer, it seems like he's the most all around.
I couldn't agree more, and I feel like he's also got the right team around him. Like that, the quality of those videos mm-hmm. is remarkable. Like the production quality,
yeah,
they're as good as his $3 million movie that he made, but they're for free on YouTube and there's one a month. It's like, I can't believe how fortunate. It's such a good time to be a viewer, you know?
I know. Speaking of my kids again too, my boys, like, they gobble that stuff up.
Do they?
Oh yeah.
Good.
It's like,
that's important for Hurley to hear, you know, like it is,
yeah,
you know. And yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, I watched those and it revitalized my love of not only surfing and him, but the art form of filmmaking.
Well, you see so many web clips that are the same irreversibles over and over again. It's like, it just becomes, you don't, it just becomes white noise or fuzz where you don't even, they're not memorable, or there's just not motivated to watch them. And then you watch, you know, him do one combo where he does like a full rotation on a hairy wave, you know, like a big overhead left and do like a big turn. It's just really, it's like, wow. It has that ooh and ah moment.
His lines that he draws, even with like a rail turn, they're just different. Mm-hmm. And his body styling and like the application of where the torque is in the turn is just radical and different. You know, it's really, really remarkable. What do you see? What are your thoughts on all these things that we talk about in terms of board design, maybe asymmetry and board construction, and how those things translate to the tour?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always fun. It's so interesting to me. You know, it seems like this last year, especially, you know, a lot of there's been an introduction of a lot of new technology by a lot of big labels, and it always still comes down to, though, that the top 34 guys can choose whatever they want to ride, right?
Yeah.
And they always go back to, I don't know why that is, but they always go back to the tried and true. So that does say something, you know, for those things that you can't quantify, but it's interesting to me that most of those guys ride a traditional constructed, lightly glassed PU board, so.
We've seen Kelly Slater experiment more than anybody.
Yeah.
And with varying degrees of success. Mm-hmm. I would say this year, he's been not successful riding his Slater designs with Firewire.
I don't think that has anything to do with his surfing, though. I think he's, like, you watch, like, individual clips of him surfing. I think he would beat his 22-year-old self if he was in a contest today. So.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me just in the broader, just in general, you know, whether it's Mick Vanning or any of those guys.
If you're seeing the results from riding asymmetrical boards, that they are beneficial and more, you know, beneficial to your surfing, why do we not see that on the tour? Why don't we see more asymmetry on tour?
Yeah, I think it's tougher. I think those guys are in a tougher position to, you know, to venture off. I think, like, Shane Horan used to ride all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, and he wasn't necessarily rewarded for that at the time. Maybe historically looking back, people have more of an admiration for him for trying and riding different things. But then it didn't really benefit him. And so, I don't know, maybe that's just historically, guys are less, they're more risk averse to go out and try something different.
I suppose so. If it was a subtle design adjustment that the commentators might not even notice or even talk about, only the surfer and the shaper really knew, you know, in regard to fin cluster being adjusted or whatever, but it allowed the surfer to turn tighter, more sensitivity. That seems like a solution. It doesn't have to be a radical departure from their current design, but some subtle in between.
I think too, like there are exceptions on with that level of surfer where guys that are really interested in new ideas or different constructions or different approaches to boards. But a lot of those guys, they're focused on performance of what they're actually doing in the water, like what maneuvers they're executing and how well they're surfing and what it looks, how it comes off and all that stuff. That seems to be, that fills much more of the forefront of their thought rather than the design of their boards.
Right.
A little bit. So, whereas I'm a board designer, so that's 90% of what I think about is like, you know, so they're probably just not thinking about it in that way. They probably think about just,
The impetus has to come from the designer themselves. Like, their shaper needs to sit them down. Maybe experiment with it with other surfers and then apply it to.
But maybe they wouldn't be that good at surfing if they're in the weeds thinking about the, you know, the little specifics. They're thinking more on the grant, you know, how can I just go fast and do a big air and do a big turn, you know?
You know where I see the largest potential for design evolution is in big wave surfing. You know, like, guys paddling into waves and going straight down the line, straight to the bottom, sometimes down the line, is boring. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see some more radical surfing in bigger waves. And I think that the reason why we don't see that is because surfboard design limits mm-hmm. what they can do. You have this catch 22 where you need a lot of foam to paddle into these giant waves, but a lot of foam prevents you from turning a board. So mm-hmm. what are your thoughts on that, and where do you see potential?
Well, they also have the hard thing of maybe only getting 3 or 4 swells in a year, in a given year.
True.
To really go out, and it's like there's not much experimentation time when you get 2 days to make it happen that month, and that's your job, that's your gig as a big wave surfer, to go out and get shots or go chart, you know, that's what you've been training for months,
right?
And so it's tough to say, okay, let's play around with all this different equipment and different fin setups, and
when your life is at risk, by the way.
Yeah. And you know, I think probably, you know, toe surfing is kind of kooky a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, but as far as like progression of actual big wave riding, there was probably more progressive turns and approaches with those kinds of boards, but it's kind of cheating, and it's not as respectable as mm-hmm. paddling in with your bare hands. And so there's probably some sort of middle ground as far as, you know, how that progresses. But it's amazing how much those guys progress and charge with all those variables that come into play, with the few swells that they get,
right,
with the, you know.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
What are some design elements that you think would expedite that learning curve for a big wave gun?
Well, I mean, asymmetry for sure. Why not, right?
Think so?
Yeah, I mean, like I think there's definitely some viable aspects of those fin setups that would allow for different lines or speed generation, you know, mm-hmm. and allowing... I made a 8.7 for the boardroom show this last year. This past one, it was celebration of guns and big wave surfing. And so the gun I made was an 8.7, and it was an asymmetrical gun. And, you know, it's 8.7 is considered small, but
sure.
Wide point and foam was kind of placed in a different way. And
okay.
So fin setup. So something like an 8.7 that maybe paddles more like a 9.6 and
yeah.
can fit in little tighter spots. And,
yeah, I mean, Albie Layer rides smaller boards at Jaws, mm-hmm. but he sits on a different part of the wave. He sits mm-hmm. on kind of the inside bowl and tries to get barreled, and that's why he's able to ride smaller boards. Mm-hmm. That board, and I mean, John as an example of somebody who rides really small boards at Pipeline when it's
yeah.
maxed out, and he's still
yeah.
riding a short board. But I think he's actually utilizing it the same way Albie is, where he sits and takes off later than everybody else. He needs smaller length to kind of get in that curve of the wave that's hollow. The board that you made for the boardroom show, was it ever surfed?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
where?
Boardroom show was in May.
Right.
So kind of post El Nino season.
Yeah.
And so Mike Townsend, the guy who's been surfing it, he's been surfing it a bunch to get the feel for it, so that when the waves are good this winter,
okay.
he's got it locked in. But he's had some, you know, double overhead days on it. Nothing that it's made for, which is, you know,
okay.
18 to 20 foot faces or something
right.
like that. So
yeah. I'm going to go back to construction real quick because I thought of a question. I can tell the difference when I ride EPS versus poly, obviously. Different foam types.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I could tell the difference between different resin types. You talked about using like a bio-based mm-hmm. Epoxy on some of the stuff. Can you?
Yeah, I do. We do a lot of PU core glass epoxy boards.
Okay.
And they go really good.
And I have some too, and I agree they go good, but can you tell the difference between epoxy resin versus polyester resin?
Yeah, it's a little...
it's a nuanced thing because the core for me is the overriding factor and how like a board's feel, you know? I mean, glassing obviously affects the weight and flex characteristics a lot. But yeah, you can feel like in a little bit of how it interacts with the surface of the water.
Okay.
A little bit. You can tell on how a board maybe loads or flexes through a turn a little bit. But it's more of a nuanced thing. It's not like a, well, this board is totally different, you know, than something of the same shape glass.
Okay.
You know, standard way.
In regard to the conversation where I was saying I feel like I just feel like polyurethane construction is better for me. Mm-hmm. It feels more familiar. It's what I'm used to. Where does the epoxy resin, does that feel preferable to polyurethane or polyester resin?
Yeah, I mean, it can take more of a punch without fracturing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, epoxy is, like, more glue-like than it is resin-like, almost. You know what I mean? And so, you know, like, if you've ever fixed a board that was epoxy, sanding epoxy is different than sanding polyester.
Okay.
You know? So it's
more gummy?
Yeah. So that's going to affect the way that it feels and that its durability, you know?
Got it.
But just more of a nuanced thing.
Okay. Interesting. I want to kind of wrap up the conversation talking about the aesthetics of album Surf, which obviously you've got the agency, which what you guys do is branding. Mm-hmm. I feel like you've done a great job with branding for album Surf. Mm-hmm. It's always on target, like, and your content strategy for Instagram and all that stuff. It's just always, always beautiful looking, on target. The messaging's always, I don't know, it's just good. It's beautiful to look at. I always like seeing the posts. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you've grown that, how you've used social media to build the brand and all that sort mm-hmm. of stuff?
Well, like I was saying, I think surfers should be open-minded, and surfers tend to be closed-minded. And so I think as far as like colors and the way a board looks, there shouldn't be, to me, I'm like, oh, let's try anything. Let's mm-hmm. make a blackboard. I like being able, the freedom of expression in that way. And so making something that's unique and that's interesting, that's part of the fun of it, you know? And so I see great opportunities in the surf world for beautiful design aesthetically. You know, I think, why not? You know, surfing's such a beautiful medium. So I love adding that aspect to it. What was the other? I forgot.
I think you've leveraged social media really well.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think it's such a great platform.
Yeah.
To show that, you know, I mean, not every type of business works with something like Instagram, where it's it's image based and it's interesting in that way. But I think it just presents itself as a great way to stoke people out. That's always been our approach, is like just making people stoked about surfing and surfboards.
Mm-hmm.
And so why not use that platform to just take it and run with it? Sometimes there's always like the fine line of, you know, I don't want to overload people's Instagram feed with boards every day, but I like to at least put a few out there every day that are,
yeah,
you know.
It does stoke me out. Like, you're right. You're achieving your goal there. I look at it and I get stoked.
Mm-hmm.
What's your board production like at this point?
Yeah, so we still do majority of what we create are custom boards for one-off customers. But yeah, we're smaller, obviously, than a lot of the bigger labels. But we probably do, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 boards a year, something like that.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
It is a lot. And especially if they're mostly custom.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So are the boards available through retail or just direct?
Yeah, we have a few retail partners all over the country and a little bit around the world, like in Asia and some other different places. Direct is really easy. You know, nowadays in the world we live in, it's really easy for someone to email us directly or call us up. You know, so we do that. We do plenty of that too. So.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, you're based in San Clemente, obviously.
Yep. So we have a showroom here in San Clemente where it's open to the public 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And lots of people like to come and stop in and see the boards. It's a great place to come and feel them and see them in person.
Yeah.
Some people have been seeing boards on social media for 2 years and then they actually get to come and see one in person. It's nice to feel it as well. And yeah. So, and then, yeah, website, social media channels.
So people can come by and grab board. What about people who don't live in Southern California? Is it relatively easy to ship boards? And how do you get stuff to people? And
yeah, we send, as you can see here, there's boxes of boards in our front room. So we ship boards out every week all over the place. Cool. So a lot of the airlines can do like air cargo shipments, which is kind of nice. So getting boards to Europe, getting boards to Australia, getting boards to Hawaii, getting boards to faraway places. Asia is relatively easy nowadays.
Okay.
And it's not, doesn't break the bank like it maybe would have a few years ago.
Yeah. So. Awesome. You know, the final question for everybody I talked to is, what was the last board you rode? I have a feeling maybe we already discussed it.
We did. It was that 600 right there.
With no fins.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned when we were talking about that board, guys who do it well, you know, like Derek Hine or whatever. I feel like those guys, though, they're riding boards that have really deep channels. Even though they might not have fins, they tend to be designed for finless surfing and have deep channels or something that gives them drive and bite, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's the same. That one has, like, sharp rails.
Okay. You know?
I mean, like, a rail with a release point like that normally causes release. You know?
Yeah.
It's a place for the water to shear off of, but it also kind of gives you, you feel like you can push it a little bit more.
Okay.
And it will kind of respond to what you're trying to do a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
But allows you to break it free, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Awesome. Is there anything else you want to say before we...
Yeah. Thanks for coming by.
Absolutely.
Love the podcast.
Thanks, man. SurfSplendorPodcast.com is our website. You could link over to Matt's website, Album Surf, from our site. Well, we also have photos of some of the boards that we discussed in this show. All sorts of stuff. And you can leave a comment as well on today's episode about Matt. Give us feedback. Chime in. Let us know if you've ridden one of Matt's boards, what you think, what your thoughts on asymmetry are, all that sort of stuff. We'll also make sure to post those things on our social media feeds, at Surf Splendor, and then on Facebook as well, facebook.com/Surf Splendor. Great way to share the show with friends on Facebook. Just copy the URL from this episode, post it on a friend's wall. Hopefully other people see it. That helps our show to grow, which, as I said at the beginning of the show, you want growth. You want this thing to grow. You will get more episodes. You will get greater guests all the way until we track down Kelly Slater himself and get him on here as a guest. That is the ultimate goal. I'll just hang it up at that point. Just give up, die happily, end goal. I'm a simple man, you know, attainable goals. At any rate, hope that you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with an episode of Surf News chiming in. Don't forget, though, that the Billabong Tahiti Pro is starting, and so if you want to join our fantasy team, you could do that on fantasysurfer.com. Go to the clubhouse, search Surf Splendor. It's free to join. There's 400 members in there. It's super fun to compete against other people. And then, of course, we, if you want to wager on that thing, we also do allow that as well. Details for how to do that are on surfsplendorpodcast.com. Click on the Fantasy Surfer tab. Hope that you have a wonderful week. Until you hear from me next week around this time on a Tuesday, this is David Scales for Surf Splendor, reminding you, do not squander your youth and your vitality. Make sure you get out in the ocean, catch a couple waves, and shred on, my fair listeners. Shred on.